and one person whose death was far more than an allegation in connection with the Judge Wood case was a former San Antonio policeman and prize fighter named Benjamin Boyd Smith. He was assassinated, most definitely, and he also was involved in the investigation into the killing of Judge John Wood. Once again, research credit for the following article goes to Ted Rubenstein. It's from the San Antonio Express, specifically from the San Antonio Express of September 1st, 1982. The headline is Wood Investigation Figure Found Slain, and it's by Karen Kennedy and Tom Nelson of the San Antonio Express, and it reads as follows. A former San Antonio policeman and prize fighter with ties to the Judge John Wood assassination investigation through his Las Vegas gambling connections was found shot and strangled in the trunk of a car left in an Austin warehouse district. Benjamin Boyd Smith, 54, had been dead at least 4 days before his body was discovered Monday morning. The Travis County coroner's report said he had been shot twice in the head and strangled with a rope. Smith had been a San Antonio police officer for 2 years before pursuing a career as a professional boxer. He later spent 10 years in prison and most recently worked as a debt collector for Las Vegas gambling interests. Smith may have been questioned during the federal probe of the May 29, 1979 Wood assassination because he had been a bodyguard for Las Vegas gambler Jack Strauss. Strauss, who won last year's World Series of Poker in Las Vegas, testified before the grand jury that he knew convicted drug smuggler Jimmy Chagra, who has been indicted on charges of arranging the assassination of the federal judge. Although Smith never appeared before the grand jury, government sources said he may have been questioned by investigators. So, the death of Benjamin Boyd Smith is another thing to keep in mind, yet another death in connection with the assassination of Judge John Wood. So, again, bearing in mind the people discussed in the article that we, in the tape segment that we covered, it's worth considering who might have dispatched Mr. Boyd Smith, why they might have done it. Bear in mind the threat against Judge Price. Bear in mind the allegations of an attempt to put out a contract on Charles Harrelson. Bear in mind the possible connections of Charles Harrelson to the assassination of President Kennedy. In fact, probable connections in light of the his probable role as the youngest tramp.
Just before we go on to some other things, I want to mention broadcasting from Foothill College. This is KFJC, Los Altos Hills. For those of you out there who are listening to this and saying, well, even if these connections, these killings and attempted killings and all that are connected, you know, so what? It's a bunch of crooks and gamblers and drug smugglers down in Texas who killed a federal judge probably and, you know, things like that. And so what? Just to let you know, what we're going to do is we're going to begin taking some of these names, some of the high-profile names, as Dave mentioned, like Santos Traficante, Carlos Marcello, and others, in the later part of the broadcast, and we're going to begin piecing this into the larger national and international drugs and intelligence connection. So, again, we're talking about this particular case because it opens some very interesting windows, namely, again, the Charles Harrelson connection possibly to the Kennedy assassination. But in the larger picture, it also fits in very much with, as I was saying earlier, things that are going on right now in terms of things that our government have probably been involved in Central and South America.
And again, recalling some of the information from the tape segment, this group is an arms and drug smuggling ring with the same nickname as our Central Intelligence Agency. They had access to weaponry at China Lake Naval Weapons Center. That is an extremely high-security installation. You just don't go waltzing in and out of China Lake with the kinds of material that they were able to get their hands on. Remember also the very possible connection to Edwin Wilson and Frank Turpel, because in the first article alluded to in the tape segment, it mentioned that the company, quote-unquote, was getting the material, the China Lake weapons, to Libya. That's where Wilson and Turpel were getting their weapons to. And again, the Kennedy assassination, possible Kennedy assassination connection. It's worth noting, too, one article we did not read, but they were, at one point, the company was reported to have been hired to assassinate the Ayatollah Khomeini. So the context in which they appear is one that strongly suggests intelligence connections.
Now, here's a rather interesting article, especially taken in context with the article coming right after it that Dave is going to read. This is from the San Jose Mercury for Thursday, September 9th, 1982. The headline is Confession Reported in Slaying of Judge. Dateline San Antonio. It's an AP story. A woman charged with conspiracy in the murder of a federal judge wrote a repentant letter to the judge's widow, confessing her role in the killing, local news media reported Wednesday. In the letter to Catherine Wood, Elizabeth Shagra said her husband told her he planned to have U.S. District Judge John H. Wood Jr. killed, and said she later delivered $250,000 in payment for the assassination. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram and WFAA-TV in Dallas quoted unidentified sources as saying. The San Antonio Express and the San Antonio Light also quoted sources as saying Mrs. Shagra admitted delivering the payment and said in the letter that she was apologetic. The Star-Telegram quoted a source as saying that, in the letter, sent from her Bexar County jail cell, Mrs. Shagra said her husband walked into the kitchen of their El Paso home while she was cooking and told her he had decided to arrange Wood's death. The source said she wrote that she later was chosen to deliver the payment because she was the only one Shagra could trust, the newspaper reported. Neither Mrs. Wood nor Assistant U.S. Attorney Ray John, JHN, would comment on the reports. Calls Tuesday night and Wednesday to Mrs. Shagra's lawyer, Warren Burnett of Galveston, were not returned. Mrs. Shagra, age 28, is accused of conspiring with her husband, Jamil Jimmy Shagra, age 39, his brother, El Paso attorney Joseph Shagra, age 35, and convicted hitman Charles V. Harrelson, age 44, to kill Wood in San Antonio on May 29, 1979. So, according to these series of articles written in the local newspapers, and apparently carrying quite a lot of detail, Elizabeth Shagra, the wife of Jamil, quote, Jimmy Shagra, actually confessed in a letter to the judge's widow that she had been informed of and, in fact, after the fact, was part of the assassination of Judge John Wood.
Does not appear, though, that his wife's, Jamil Chagra's wife's testimony had much of an effect on the outcome of the case.
It should be noted, if that was in fact the case, that I think even in a letter, a wife's testimony cannot be used against her husband. However, it seems that if it was she was so ready to confess, that other information should have been developed out of that that would have been could have been used to find Shagra guilty of such a large-scale crime.
Following story is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, February 8, 1983. Stateline Jacksonville, Florida, and it's a UPI story headlined, Gambler Acquitted of Hiring Judge's Killer. Jamil Jimmy Shagra, a Las Vegas gambler serving 30 years in prison on drug charges, was found not guilty yesterday of hiring the killer who shot down U.S. District Judge John Wood in San Antonio, Texas. A 10-woman, 2-man jury found Shagra not guilty of murder and conspiracy to murder, but convicted him on two lesser counts, conspiracy to obstruct justice and conspiracy to possess drugs. The government claimed Shagra had Wood killed in May of 1979 to avoid having to face trial in his court. A 39-year-old Shagra, a licensed professional gambler, was accused of paying Charles V. Harrelson $250,000 to kill the 61-year-old judge May 29, 1979. Harrelson, 44, was convicted of Wood's murder in San Antonio in December. So again, as Nip indicated, the acquittal of Jimmy Shagra is, in and of itself, does not prove anything. It's interesting to note, though, the interesting convolutions the case has taken. The death of a possible witness, the murder of a possible witness, threats against judges, which certainly would have to carry some weight after the assassination of Judge John Wood, the allegation by an FBI informer that he was being hired to kill Charles Harrelson. Who would have hired him, if that's true, and why, remains a subject of speculation. The possible connections to Charles Harrelson and possibly also the Marcello clan, the assassination of President Kennedy, are worth keeping in mind. And again, the intelligence-related context in which the company, quote-unquote, exists are worth thinking about here. And the perhaps the single most intriguing aspect of the assassination of Judge John Wood, and again, one of a number of killings and attempted killings attributed to the company, quote-unquote, perhaps the single most important, at least for our purposes now, aspect of it that surfaced, were allegations by Charles Harrelson that the Drug Enforcement Administration had the judge assassinated.
Indeed. This article is from the San Francisco Examiner for Thursday, December 16, 1982. The headline is, Killer Says Judge Slain by the DEA. Dateline San Antonio UPI Wire Story. Federal Judge John Wood had information that would have, quote, blown the lid off the Drug Enforcement Administration when he was killed, probably by renegade government agents, says the man convicted of Wood's murder. Charles Harrelson held a press conference yesterday in the chapel of the Bexar County Jail a day after he and two women were convicted of complicity in the slaying. Quote, I believe the government is in possession of evidence that shows conclusively I did not murder the judge, Harrelson said. I believe I was under surveillance the morning of May 29, 1979. Harrelson testified he was at his Dallas apartment when Wood was shot here, 275 miles away. Harrelson said during his 7 days of testimony that, quote, rogue elements of the U.S. government killed Wood. He elaborated at the press conference saying that the DEA killed Wood to keep him revealing that, quote, 95% of the drugs brought in this country are imported by the DEA. Let me go back and read these last two paragraphs because I think they're rather interesting, even if they are the claims of a convicted murderer, because of the facts that we're going to be examining later in the broadcast. Harrelson said during his 7 days of testimony that, quote, rogue elements of the U.S. government killed Judge Wood. He elaborated at the press conference, saying the DEA killed Wood to keep him from revealing that, quote, 95% of the drugs brought in this country are imported by the DEA. Harrelson, for the first time, brought up the name of El Paso, Texas lawyer Lee Shagra, elder brother of Jimmy Shagra, whose trial is pending on charges he hired Harrelson to kill Wood. Lee Shagra was killed in his office in December 1978 in an apparent robbery. Two soldiers later were convicted of the slaying. Quote, I believe Lee Shagra had transmitted information to Judge Wood that would have blown the lid off the DEA, unquote, Harrelson said. So, of course, Lee Shagra also apparently a question mark to add on to the death list, but more significantly for our purposes and for the broadcast we're looking at tonight, the allegations by Charles Harrelson, who has made, in the course of the of our examining this case, has made two very seemingly outrageous and sweeping allegations. One, that he was in fact one of the assassins of John F. Kennedy, which of course flies in the face of the conventional government wisdom, although as polls will tell you, not in the face of the wisdom of most people who are you know, pretty willing to believe that there was some kind of conspiracy involved in the Kennedy assassination.
Or as we indicated in the Guns of November, the laws of physics will also impel you in the same general direction.
Not to mention the final, however much flawed it might be, judgment of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, who also said it was probably an assassination conspiracy.
Excuse me, again, not only that, but they identified David Ferry, who was the chief object of Jim Garrison's investigation, as the probable conspirator, and recommended to the Justice Department that they begin investigation not only of Ferry's situation, but in particular his relationship with Carlos Marcello and the anti-Castro Cubans used by the CIA in the Bay of Pigs. And in particular, the anti-Castro Cubans are going to figure front and center in our broadcast this evening. But again, bearing in mind, as Nip indicated, the allegations by Charles Harrelson, because they're going to dovetail very, very neatly with a lot of information that we're going to be presenting on the rest of the broadcast.
That's right. So we have the first very wild, seemingly wild allegation that Harrelson, not Lee Harvey Oswald, was part of the assassination hit team that killed John F. Kennedy, and we have a second allegation that the rogue elements of the U.S. government killed Judge John Wood, and they did it because Wood had information about the DEA bringing, in Harrelson's words, 95% of the drugs into the country. Two seemingly wild allegations, and well, we've examined the Kennedy assassination in the past. Those of you who have been with us for those know about how wild those kind of allegations sound, or how very not wild they sound in light of the actual evidence. And by the end of the broadcast tonight, perhaps some of Mr. Harrelson's allegations about the DEA will be looked at in a slightly different light as well. However, all of that is going to happen after we take a break and give you all a chance to get up and stretch, since we've been a long first segment of the broadcast tonight. So don't go away. Dave Emery, myself, Nip Tuck have lots more stuff that we want to share with you, and it's going to be an interesting show. Don't go away. We'll have more of Radio Free America in just a few minutes after this musical break, right here on KFJC. Station or something like that that you let us know, so we know where they're going to. But other than that, if you just want to share them with some friends, send copies to somebody, to your grandmother, your Aunt Minnie, your congressman, you know, your best friend, your worst enemy, who might need to be depressed a little bit about the State of the Union or something, That's fine with us. That's all we ask. So
yeah. Again, if people want to play them on other stations, that's fine. So far, they're being played in part or in whole on at least 5 stations that we know of, including this one. So it's fine, as long as you check with us first. We don't want them used for comedy, as a recent station did. So check it out first.
Indeed. And I should also just mention again that we're going to be here until 11 o'clock tonight. This is not a phone-in broadcast, so if you're only waiting around to phone and ask questions, that will probably not happen. If you've got a question to ask, we do, of course, have our regular broadcasts on Sunday that run from 8 o'clock until 11 o'clock, where we do take phone calls and where we cover these kinds of things, except we usually have 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 or 12 topics during a given broadcast. So just to let you know again real quickly, we've been talking about the company. We've been talking about the company with the focus initially in the first part of the broadcast being on the death of Judge John Wood of San Antonio, the first federal judge ever to be murdered, and at least as far as we know, the first judge to be murdered. He was apparently murdered because of his work in some as a judge on some drug smuggling cases. A man named Jimmy Shagra, a professional gambler who was already doing time for drug offenses, was acquitted, although the man that he reputedly hired to perform the case was not acquitted and was found guilty, a man named Charles V. Harrelson. Charles V. Harrelson also had some other interesting things to say. We talked about some of his connections into the Dallas underworld and the world, the milieu that produced some of the people involved in the Kennedy assassination, which was significant for a variety of reasons. First off, being that Harrelson himself said that he had been a member of the Kennedy assassination team, and secondly, because Harrelson said that the reason John Wood had been killed, it had not been by him, it had been by the government, and it was because John Wood had been in possession of information about how vastly involved the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, was with the importation of drugs into this country. So the affiliation of John Harrelson with a lot of the milieu of the Kennedy assassination, most notably including certain aspects of organized crime, people like Santos Traficante and Carlos Marcello, and with the Cuban exile community, will be highly significant as we move into the drug and intelligence trade for this evening in earnest. And the only other thing to remember is, remember, folks, this is not old news. This is exactly what the allegations are of what's going on right now in Nicaragua. And indeed, as we mentioned, Ed Wilson ties into the, quote, company because of his involvement with the theft of weapons from China Lake, which is where the, quote, company's weapons came from. Because Ed Wilson and his milieu are all involved with the Iran-Contra scam as well. So this is as real and as fresh as this morning's papers, tomorrow morning's papers.
Now, we're going to pick up basically where we left off at the end of the discussion of the assassination of Judge John Wood by, quote, the company, an arms-for-drug smuggling ring which appears to have certain connections to the U.S. intelligence community, certainly involves many of the same elements. There was an article in an underground paper, a now defunct underground paper called the Soho News in New York, which maintained that there were some links between the company, quote-unquote, and the Nugenhan Bank. Unfortunately, that too is buried somewhere deep in our archives, and we don't have that on tape, regrettably. But bear in mind Charles Harrelson's statement that renegade or rogue U.S. agents had Judge John Wood assassinated because he had information that would have proved that the Drug Enforcement Administration imported 95% of the drugs into this country. And as Nip indicated, with the current administration making a very public show of their alleged drug enforcement policies, and with anywhere people ranging from train engineers to airplane pilots to professional athletes having to undergo, and amateur athletes as well, having to go rigorous drug testing, that's a possibility that's worth thinking about. Now, the role of the Drug Enforcement Administration as a drug enforcement agency, rather, as an adjunct to the CIA and as a major element in the narcotics traffic itself, is going to be the focus of our broadcast this evening. We're going to begin by taking up with a book that is going to provide the information for the bulk of the rest of our broadcast, and specifically we're going to take up with a section of that book that we dealt with at the end of our last program, Radio Free America number 25. The book is called The Great Heroin Coup, subtitled Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism. It's authored by freelance Danish journalist Henrik Kruger, K-R-U-G-E-R, published in softcover by the South End Press, copyrighted 1980, and with an excellent foreword by Berkeley researcher Peter Dale Scott. In a chapter that we read from last time, called appropriately enough Guns for Drugs, detailing the interrelationship between the activities of Robert Vesco, Mitchell Werbel, the late U.S. intelligence agent and special operations specialist, and Santos Traficante, the aforementioned mafioso and associate of U.S. intelligence agency who may very well have had a role in the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, as we looked at the conclusion of our broadcast last time, Radio Free America number 25, author Jim Hogan put forth a scenario whereby Robert Vesco, Santos Traficante, and Mitch Werbel were going to use the profits from the narcotics traffic to, among other things, help finance the production of machine guns in Latin America, and in turn, use those machine guns and the drug profits to finance anti-communist death squads and terror groups in Latin America. We're going to pick up with a section of the article, of that chapter that we dealt with last time, and specifically this is going to deal with some information implicating the DEA, once again, in not only the narcotics traffic, but in harassing and threatening to murder people who were exposing their involvement or alleged involvement in the narcotics traffic. Reading now from the chapter Guns for Drugs, from The Great Heroin Coup by Henry Krueger. IOS here, by the way, is Investors Overseas Services, a company that Robert Vesco ran in partnership with a fellow named Bernard Kornfeld. The fugitive IOS billionaire Vesco employed a large contingent of Cuban exiles in his Costa Rica sanctuary. Moreover, his weapons negotiations coincided with the efforts of the fanatic anti-Castro Cuban leader Orlando Bosch, B-O-S-C-H, to assemble Cuban exile groups into an army of terror, CORU, C-O-R-U, that would later carry out assassinations and other dirty work for several Latin American regimes. During Bosch's 1974 and 75 drive, a wave of murder struck Miami's Cuban exile haven. Most victims had been opposed to Bosch. With the obstacles to his plan removed, CORU was established in June of 1976. While Vesco and Werbel were hatching their weapons deal, Bosch's base of operation just happened to be Vesco's kingdom of Costa Rica, and mafia heroin boss Santos Traficante Jr. was also reportedly there between January of 1974 and the summer of 1975. Journalist Jim Hogan speculates in his book Spooks that the three might have joined forces in a CIA conspiracy to escalate anti-communist terror in Latin America. In 1973, some of the details began to surface in a series of scandals linking these individuals. DEA undercover agent Frank Peroff, P-E-R-O-F-F, charged Vesco with financing extensive heroin smuggling. For his initiative, Peroff was fired summarily and his life was threatened. Before the Senate Investigation Subcommittee could probe deeply, the case was squelched through the intervention of the White House. The Oval Office had already helped Vesco, a friend of the Nixon family, in his run-in with the Securities and Exchange Commission, which had sought his prosecution for the trail of the swindle he had left in the world of international finance. Midway through the subcommittee investigation of the heroin charges, the DEA announced the disappearance of its Vesco file. By the way, you can read about the misadventures of Frank Peroff in a book called Peroff by H.L. Whittemore. That's an excellent book, and I recommend it to anyone who would like to investigate it. Once again here, we have allegations, and allegations which at least circumstantially appear to be true, of the DEA's collaboration with drug smugglers, and of course that's exactly what Charles Harrelson was charging.
Indeed, and before I go on to the next segment, was this the time when William Casey was involved with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the time of this Vesco inquiry?
He was the head of it. He was the head of it at this time.
That's rather interesting.
He's, of course, now the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, although I don't know, and it remains to be seen how much of a head he has left after his alleged brain cancer.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
What we're going to be dealing with now for the rest of the broadcast is a scenario developed by journalist Henry Krueger, whereby the Drug Enforcement Administration, and specifically an alleged anti-drug dealer assassination team put together of alleged former CIA agents. Well, basically, Krueger is suggesting that rather than seeking to eliminate the drug traffic through this wave of assassinations, they were seeking to eliminate the Corsican mob, the Corsican syndicate, the Union Corps competition to the Sicilian and Lansky syndicate heroin traffic. Now, What basically Krueger is maintaining is that Richard Nixon, with his many documented ties not only to the Lansky and Sicilian organized crime syndicates, but also to the narcotics traffic, and we took a look at his setting up his lobbying as a lawyer for Pepsi-Cola and establishment of a Pepsi plant, which turned out to be one of the largest heroin refineries in Southeast Asia. We looked at that in RFA number 24. But Richard Nixon's connections to organized crime are a matter of public record, and they are deep and they are extensive. And by way of looking at our discussion this evening, and by way of introducing our discussion, I should say, and taking a look at Krueger's thesis that, in fact, the White House and DEA assassination teams were used to corral the narcotics traffic, not to suppress it, we're going to begin by taking a look at Richard Nixon's connections to organized crime and some of the organized crime and intelligence elements that figure so prominently in our story this evening and throughout the course of our investigation into the involvement of the intelligence services in the narcotics traffic.
Reading further from Henrik Krueger's Great Heroin Coup. Richard Nixon's connections to the syndicate and its stooges are a matter of record. The only question is when they began. Some say it was 1946 when Nixon ran for Congress in California and Murray Chotiner, C-H-O-T-I-N-E-R, a top syndicate defense attorney, ran his campaign with support from the gangster Mickey Cohen. Others place the Nixon underworld wedding as early as 1943, when Nixon was working in the Office of Price Administration at a desk responsible for controlling the market in rubber goods. There he allegedly met his future pals George, quote, the senator from Cuba, Smathers, and the Cuban-American Bebe Rebozo, who later struck it rich in real estate. The two were then small time. Smathers, a lawyer for a syndicate front smuggling auto tires from Cuba, Rebozo, the owner of a gas station that sold the tires. The Florida clique was a happy family. Nixon liked to take fishing jaunts with the likes of Rebozo, Meyer Lansky's associate Tatum Chubby Wofford, and Richard Danner, who would later manage the Sands Casino in Las Vegas for Howard Hughes. He also got to know people even closer to the syndicate, who had extensive interests in Cuba. In 1952, one short month after the dictator Batista's comeback, Nixon and Danner joined throngs of tourists who unloaded their savings at one of the syndicate's Cuban casinos. Nixon would return frequently. He, Rebozo, and Smathers allegedly invested in the island during the 1950s. And in 1955, as Vice President of the United States, Nixon would pin an award on Batista, with whom he was photographed in the dictator's palace. Nixon also helped plan the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1959. Chairing the 5412 Group, a National Security Council subcommittee in charge of covert actions, the Vice President pushed for the plan's approval before his 1960 presidential race against John F. Kennedy. According to Howard Hunt, Nixon was the invasion's, quote, secret action officer in the White House. President Eisenhower, who would later plead ignorance of the plan's extent, assumed it was limited to support for anti-Castro guerrillas in the mountains. When JFK took over the Oval Office, he was presented with a fait accompli. If Eisenhower was really left out in the cold on the plan's magnitude, then William Pauley must have been among Nixon's co-conspirators. As mentioned earlier, Pauley talked Eisenhower into arming the anti-communist Cubans. Pauley, spelled P-A-W-L-E-Y, was, and would remain, one of Nixon's most ardent supporters. When the invasion proved a bust, Nixon's voice was among the loudest, accusing Kennedy of undermining it by refusing reinforcements. In the years that had followed, he continued to cultivate support among the Cuban exiles and other right-wing constituencies. Cubans for Nixon and Asians for Nixon touted him as a man who would not forsake the cause of anti-communism. The Nixon of near-hysterical anti-communism would win additional allies in the syndicate and in the powerful business circles tied in with the military and espionage. Fortunately for Nixon, forces behind the above lobbies were also influential in organized labor, especially the Teamsters Union. Teamster boss Jimmy Hoffa became a pawn of the Lansky Syndicate, which borrowed millions from the union's pension fund. However, Hoffa's obsequiousness towards the mob was dampened by Attorney General Robert Kennedy's aggressive investigation of Teamster policies. In 1967, prior to Nixon's decisive electoral campaign, Hoffa landed in jail with a 13-year sentence for misuse of union funds. The new Teamster strongmen, Frank Fitzsimmons and Anthony Tony Pro Provenzano, were friends of Nixon and in the hands of the syndicate. When Nixon pardoned Hoffa just prior to Christmas 1971, Hoffa had to promise to stay out of organized labor. In the 60s, Nixon grew even closer to his friends in Miami, who by then had made millions in land speculation. Dade County, north of Miami, became known as Lanskyville, as a string of seemingly legitimate real estate firms handled the Lansky mob's enormous holdings. Among the more prominent firms were the following.
The Cape Florida Development Company, run by Donald Berg, B-E-R-G, and Nixon's pal Rebozo. The two worked closely with Al Polizzi, P-O-L-I-Z-Z-I, the former head of the syndicate's Mayfield Road gang in Cleveland, then in charge of the syndicate's Florida contractors. An investigation into the placement of stolen securities at Rebozo's bank was nipped in the bud. The Mary Carter Paint Company, which in 1967 became Resorts International, that now runs the world's most profitable casino in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and was purportedly the brainchild of Mr. Lansky. Resorts Paradise Island Casino in the Bahamas was managed by Ed Cellini, C-E-L-L-I-N-I, a long-time Lansky casino operator. The General Development Corporation, run by two Lansky strawmen, Wallace Groves and Lou Chesler, C-H-E-S-L-E-R. Its board of directors included Lansky broker Max Orovitz, O-R-O-V-I-T-Z, and the gangster trigger Mike Coppola. Groves bought up half of Grand Bahama Island for the syndicate and contracted with Nixon's law client National Bulk Carriers to construct a harbor there. The Major Realty Company, whose controlling shareholders were Senator Smathers and Lansky's men Orovitz and Ben Siegelbaum. Through his friends, Nixon acquired land on Key Biscayne and Fisher's Island off the Florida coast. In return, he readily made himself available for personal appearances. When Mary Carter in 1967 opened the Nassau Bay Club Casino on Grand Bahama Island, Nixon was the guest of honor. 1 year later, he was there when Resorts International opened its casino on Paradise Island. Nixon also expressed his friendship in other ways. Hoffa was not the only one who did not have to pay his full debt to society. Neither did Leonard Burstyn, B-U-R-S-T-E-N, Carl Covens, K-O-V-E-N-S, or Morris Schenker, S-H-E-N-K-E-R, all syndicate associates, the last two solid Nixon campaign supporters. Robert Morgenthau, the federal attorney for the Southern District of New York, became interested in some of Nixon's friends in 1968. He proved Max Orovitz guilty of willful violation of stock registration laws and was investigating syndicate money transfers to Switzerland. The latter threatened to lead to an indictment of Nixon's friend, John M. King, of Investors Overseas Services. Morgenthau, however, was removed from office.
Continuing with the great heroin coup. Glancing at major contributors to Nixon's 1968 and 1972 campaign chests, one finds the names of Miami strawmen Lou Chesler and Richard Pistell, P-I-S-T-E-L-L, Resorts President James Crosby, and John M. King, the Texas billionaire Howard Hughes, master swindler Robert Vesco, and the California millionaire C. Arnholt Smith, a close associate of the gangster John Alessio, and later convicted of misuse of bank funds. The list of Nixon's major personal and political supporters starts with Rebozo, Smathers, Dewey, Hoffa, and Frank Fitzsimmons, all with their syndicate associations, and goes on to include William Pauley and the China Lobby's Madam Anna Chan Chenault. Nearly all of Nixon's major supporters in Florida were involved in one way or another in the Bay of Pigs operation. The same can be said of the top syndicate figures, four of whom escorted the invasion force in a yacht for part of the voyage, while Trafficante's lieutenants in Miami and the Dominican Republic stood ready to seize the casinos. Let me just pop in here real quickly. That's, of course, Santos Trafficante, who we've been talking about earlier, the Florida Mafia chieftain. Moreover, one cannot overlook Nixon's particular connection to IOS multimillionaire Vesco, who until recently was in exile in Costa Rica, where he allegedly financed the smuggling of narcotics. Vesco provided covert financial aid to Nixon's re-election campaign and was closely associated with Nixon's brother Edward and nephew Donald Jr. Richard Nixon himself is alleged to have met secretly with Vesco in Salzburg, Austria. The White House finally came to Vesco's aid in a case brought against him by the Securities and Exchange Commission, just as an investigation of his narcotics activities was similarly choked off. Okay, so in this long segment, we've got a lot of stuff. The basic thing we're talking about here, although, again, you will notice that some of these people are still players today, whether if they are the organizations, the Trafficante organization and others still in existence, or, as we mentioned earlier here, the Securities and Exchange Commission investigation choked off by orders of the White House into Vesco's illegal dealings, of course, and as we mentioned a moment ago, William Casey was head of the Securities and Exchange Commission at that time, and of course now, among other things, he is the head of the CIA, the putative head at this point. Now, the main thing here that we're noticing, though, is the fact that it looks like very early on in his administration, or in his career, rather, that Richard Nixon was, in effect, tapped on the shoulder by the Lansky mob and other syndicate figures and was told, "You're our boy, Dick," just in the way that George Smathers became the senator from Cuba and had massive help in becoming a Florida senator from the Florida syndicate. Richard Nixon, all throughout his career, had key help, financial and otherwise, from the mob, the Lansky mob among others, and you can see going back to at least 1946, if not 1943, when he was just a guy playing poker in the Navy.
Now, again, the involvement of Richard Nixon throughout his political career with organized crime elements, and in particular with the anti-Castro Cuban exile community, is worth noting. Also, by the way, his connections to the China lobby and its powerful narcotics connections. We discussed the Bay of Pigs in a number of broadcasts, of course, in our Radio Free America shows, or in our Guns of November shows, rather, numbers 1 and 2 in particular. We talked about some of the anti-Castro Cubans and their relationship to the Bay of Pigs. It's also worth noting, too, that in Radio Free America number 12, we went into the what we call the Cuban Fry Corps at great length. We talked about the whole Bay of Pigs in Operation 40 at considerable length there. Once again, the anti-Castro Cubans from the Bay of Pigs have been front and center in the recent Iran-Contragate that we are going to be covering at some point in the not-too-distant future in a Radio Free America series. And again, narcotics trafficking is front and center in the background of, or not in the background, in the foreground of that case as well. We took a look at Richard Nixon and his connections, again, to the Bay of Pigs and U.S. intelligence apparatus in relation to the Bay of Pigs. And that's that and the Nixon's Lansky connections, and also, again, the China lobby connections are worth noting here, because what we're going to be examining is Kruger's thesis that basically the federal intelligence apparatus and the drug enforcement apparatus were used by the Nixon White House to corral the international heroin traffic for Nixon's mob and anti-Castro Cuban buddies. And that, of course, is consistent with the allegations made not only by Charles Harrelson, but also by L.H. Whittemore and former DEA agent Frank Peroff, that in fact the DEA is involved in the narcotics traffic, not in helping to suppress the narcotics traffic.
And again, it cannot be stressed too strongly. Now, we have examined fairly recently, and we'll be examining in some depth tonight, some of the involvement with the anti-Castro Cubans and their involvement in the milieu, and then the same circles that they run in we'll be looking at in later broadcasts, Radio Free America broadcasts on this subject, as we begin to get into Klaus Barbie's Coca Fascista Network and others running up out of Latin America. But since we haven't discussed it in depth tonight, we might want to go back real quickly and look at the China lobby. For those not familiar with those, just to briefly reiterate a couple of things. The China lobby, of course, has become a slang term for the group of people who were either literally supporters of Chiang Kai-shek in China at the time that the Chiang Kai-shek government, always suspect at the best of times, crumbled utterly during the Chinese Revolution, and they were forced out and wound up in Taiwan. But besides that, there was also a large American contingent of supporters of Chiang Kai-shek, and we've talked about it at some great length, and out of the American supporters of Chiang Kai-shek sprang such things as the John Birch Society, and the Anna Chennault mentioned here was the wife of General Claire Chennault, U.S. Army Air Corps, who was himself a good buddy and confidant of Chiang Kai-shek. Now, at the time that the Chiang Kai-shek government fell, large quantities of his soldiers fled across the border of China into various Southeast Asian countries, and it was at the time that they were a rogue army on the loose in Southeast Asia that the next connection between Chiang Kai-shek and the China lobby and the drug trade come into effect.